finish the last tape, I was talking about the opening of the oil show in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and how I was invited to be there by my boss for the grand opening. And after flag raising and the speeches were all over, then they opened the gates and we went into the oil show and arrived at the instrument company's booth, and there it was, all covered up with drapes. And I was told I was to pull the string that undraped it, which I did, at the flashing of cameras and so on. And there was their booth with a great big sign on the front of the panel board saying, "Our new full scope controllers." And by courtesy of Homer Givens of Shell Petroleum Corporation, my boss then told me that because of allowing the instrument company to use that name, Full Scope, I was being given a $5 a month raise in pay as courtesy for allowing the instrument company to copyright the name and use it on their instruments. On the original instruments, the automatic reset had been on top of the valve in what they call the double response unit. But in this instrument, the reset was put in the instrument itself so that you didn't have to have the extra piece on top of the valve, because it wouldn't fit all valves of all makes, which needed to be done. Therefore, they had put it in the instrument. A month and a half after this episode, I was promoted to field engineer, traveling all plants out of the Tulsa office and moved into Tulsa. This was July the 1st, 1934. I was assigned first job at Pampa, Texas. They had a column there that was an absorber, absorbing gasoline from the natural gas, and it wasn't working properly. It was carrying over the oil instead of letting it come back down like it should. And I was to go out there and tell them what to do to fix it. I got there and we could put a little bit of oil over, but not very much, without it carrying over and wasn't getting the gas stripped properly. I had found out while working in the laboratory at this first plant I was assigned to that if you had a carbon buildup in anything, dirt and such, that it could be cleaned with caustic soda. So I says to the fellow, the superintendent of the plant, Jim, let's put a bunch of water in this absorber, fill it clear full, dump in a barrel of caustic soda, and then heat it up with steam. See what that will do. So he says, okay, I'll try anything. So we filled this column full of, plenty full of water. Then we put in the caustic soda, mixed up, and put it into the column and filled it up the rest of the way. Hooked the steam line to the bottom of it and started to heat it up. Heated it up and got it a steaming good out the top. And we did that for about an hour. I said, let's drain it. And you never saw such dirty water in your life as came out of that thing. Oily carbon flakes and everything else in it. And he says, I bet it works. We put it on and put the oil to it, and it worked perfectly. That increased my image considerably with the company. I was then told that the one of the other plants there in the Panhandle of Texas, called the Skellytown Number 2 plant, was not making the gasoline it should, and please go see what is wrong while you're out there. And so I went over to Skelly Plant Number 2, and I looked the place over, and I could find nothing particularly wrong at all. But still, it wasn't making the gasoline it should make by our calculations or known what it had done before. So I heard that there was some big shots coming into the area out there. So I went over and parked my way down behind the cooling tower where I could look out over the plant and act like I was hiding out from the big shots, which all the fellows in the plant knew that were coming. And I observed, and I found out that a direct-fired heater that had to heat the absorption oil was on a manual control, and sometimes it was way too hot, sometimes it was way too cold, as they didn't handle the firing just right. So I went back into Tulsa and turned in a report on that, and they told me to fix it up and do whatever I needed to. So I got a temperature controller and went out and shut the plant down for a couple hours and installed this temperature controller on this oil heater, and they turned the thing to on, started it up, got the thing, the temperature controller adjusted where it was working right, and in less than a month's time, we'd increased the production of that plant to more than pay for the controller. This one trip to the Panhandle that first week set me into being very good engineer with gasoline plants, and they told me to go run a plant balance on all the other plants, of which there were about 8 more, and see what might be done to increase their efficiency. However, most of the other plants were working very good and didn't need much assistance in getting up to perfect efficiency. Perfect efficiency as then known. A couple months later, or around the 1st of December, I believe it was, I was told that there was a young fellow coming over to be a trainee of some kind, and his home was London, and that he was to travel with me for a good while and learn about gasoline processing plants, gas processing plants. Found out he is coming in on a certain train into the Tulsa Union Depot, and that I was to meet him there. And he says, you will know him, you won't have to ask everybody who he is, because as quick as he gets off the train, comes through the gate, you'll know that he's an Englishman by the way he's dressed. So I went down to the depot when just before the train was to come in, and I was watching the people come through the gate, Sure enough, pretty quick I saw this fellow. Recognized right away that he was an Englishman, and a young fellow, probably 3 or 4 years younger than I was. And I went up to him and asked him for him by name, if he was, that was his name. He said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Well, I'm to meet you, and you're to travel with me for a while." I said, "Right now, we'll go up to the office, and you'll meet the people there. And probably tomorrow, we'll start out visiting some plants." He says, "Okay," or English equivalent to that. I don't remember what it is now. It might have been cheerio or some such a thing. Anyway, we had a red cap get his bag, and we went out, and here was my old 1933 Chevrolet Coupe, a company car that was assigned to me. He looked at it, and he says, "You must be somewhat high up in the company." I said, "No, there's..." Says, "I think the office boy is in the office is the only person under me that's lower down on the scale than I am." He says, "Well, they sure give you a big automobile to meet me in." I said, "No, that's assigned to me." I says, "We'll travel in that." He says, "That large automobile?" I says, "Oh, that's one of the smallest cars here in the United States." He says, "Well, I'd heard that you had bigger cars, but I didn't realize it was that much bigger." He turned out to be a right jolly good chap. I think it was the next day after I got him, we started out to Pampa, Texas, and we stopped at some place along the road and filled up with gasoline. And the fella didn't get the hood fastened down. One of those when the hood lifted up from the side, and they had to work the catches pretty well to get them fastened back down. And this fella forgot to, or didn't get one side of it fastened down very well, and it began to flap in the breeze. As we started out, I said, "That guy didn't get the hood fastened down." And I pulled off the road, come to a stop, and fastened the thing down. He'd got out and was looking around. And I got back in. I said, "Well, we got it, let's go." And he said, "Well, I thought you just said the hood wasn't fastened down." I says, "It wasn't." "Well, what?" And I said, "Well, didn't you see me fasten it down out there?" He says, "Oh, that's the hood?" He says, "We call that the bonnet." And he said, "I was looking, the hood is what's over us." I said, "Well, that is the top here." I said, "And the hood is over the engine." He says, "Well, I may learn all of your idiosyncrasies on calling things for automobiles for very long, man, and I'll have to begin to remember all those things." I said, "By the way, you've never driven in a United States automobile before, have you?" And he says, "No, I sure haven't." I said, "Now would be a good time for you to learn, because this next stretch of road is a long, nice, straight stretch of road, be a good time for you to learn to drive this thing, because you may have to sometime." He said, "Okay." So I let him drive, and he wasn't a bad driver. He'd driven little British cars, and he learned right quick how to shift the gears, and he did a good job of steering. And so he was driving along, and I says, "Well, you can drive clear on into Tampa." and we were going to the Snyder Hotel to spend the night. I told him where to turn, and we got the Snyder Hotel and checked in there. And next day, we went out to this plant right close to Tampa 15, and we went out there and was doing some work, and the superintendent of the plant and I were doing some testing work, and it come along before long in the testing, we was going to need a fitting. So I told this Britisher, I says, you get old 8303 there and go into the Continental Supply Company. He says, you'd better write this down for me. So I wrote down, go in Pampa to the Continental Supply Company, which was right on the edge of town. As he got there, I told him what fitting I wanted. So he left, and it was only about a 4-mile trip into town into this Continental Supply, and he was gone and gone and gone for, it shouldn't have been taking him more than 15 minutes to make the trip, but he was gone for a good 35 minutes, and we were beginning to need this fitting. So I said, well, we got to go hunt him. So we got in the superintendent's car and we started out. And about halfway into Tampa, we found him. And he had a flat tire. And stopped. He says, I'm frightfully inefficient about your motor cars. He says, I know I'm frightfully inefficient. He says, I couldn't find the lift. I says, the lift? He says, yeah, the thing that you hitched it up with to so you can take the wheel off and put the other one on. I said, oh, you mean the jack. Oh, he says, that's what it is a jack. Well, what's it look like? So I got in the trunk and hauled out this jack. He says, I don't look like any lift that we have in our cars over there. I says, no, what you've got wouldn't even start to lift this car. And he says, well, probably so. So we put the spare on for him, and I got in, went on in, and took the spare tire to a filling station, told him to fix it, got our fitting, went back, and he says, you're going to go without the spare tire. I says, well, we'll get it and we come back in to the hotel tonight. And he says, I'm learning fast. And he turned out to be a very fine young fellow, and I really liked him, kept in touch with him for several years after this, and he last time I knew, he was in The Hague, and the Shell Petroleum Office in The Hague, and that was before the war started. I never heard from him since the war. I don't know what's happened to him now. I got one letter from him while he was still there in the United States, and he says, well, you taught me a lot, but you didn't tell me about snipe hunting. He said, I was taking snipe hunting out here by McCamey, and he says, you hadn't warned me about that. So I now know about snipe hunting in the United States. Sometime after this, they put another young fellow traveling with me as a trainee, and he was a graduate of the Rollo School of Mines of Missouri, I believe it was, and a very nice young fellow. And one day we were traveling, going to Tonkawa, Oklahoma. The road was not too wide. It hadn't been mowed along the side of it. Weeds was quite high. And I was rambling along at about 50 miles an hour, and an old cow walked out of the road, out of the weeds onto the road in front of me. And I slammed on the brakes and came down to a stop, and the left-hand end of the bumper just barely bumped the old cow's left-hand hind leg. She kicked at me and walked on across the road. And I'd noticed this young fellow had taken his glasses off and was cleaning them just before the cow stepped out on the road. And he finished cleaning his glasses and put them on, and he says, "You pretty near got a horse, didn't you?" I said, "What do you mean a horse?" I says, "Can't you tell the difference between a cow and a horse?" And he says, "Well, not without my glasses very well." And really, first I knew he was practically blind. Around the 1st of June of 35, one morning I was in the office, and the head of the department called me into his office, and he says, "I've got a job for you." I said, "Well, okay." Very seldom did he call me in and tell him that he had a job for me. He says, the company is changing its policy some. He says, "I'm being transferred to New York City, and the head of the White Pipelines," that is pipelines that carried kerosene and gasoline and other non-colored products, petroleum products, non-petroleum looking products. LPGs was included in that, and so on. Anyway, he says, "I'm being transferred to New York to take care of those." And as this, the gasoline department is going to be put under the production department, and he named the fellow that had been there a long time. He says he is going to be the advisor to the production vice president and manager of production. Said he's going to be his advisor on the natural gasoline department to him. And all the plants will come under the production superintendents, and the gasoline plant superintendents now will get a $25 a month pay raise, and their title changed to gasoline plant chief engineer. And you're to make all the plants and tell all the superintendents about that move. That was about between 9:30 and 10 o'clock in the morning. And so I thought, well, I might as well get started on this chore, and I'll choose to go to Dumright, one of the plants that was, I could get there just about time for lunch. And the superintendent there was a good friend of mine, and he had a son that always came over because of the central laboratory for the whole company was there. The gasoline plants was there, Drumright plant, and I was always taking samples in there, and the superintendent's son would always come over and have me help tune his bicycle up because he knew I had good tools and would like, I would help him while the fellow was running my samples off in the laboratory. And so I got out there, and just the time to go to lunch, and the fellow, the superintendent, and I went to lunch. Came back, and I says, Earl, I got some news. I says, the boss up in the office is being transferred to New York City and head of the pipelines. And Doc B is going to be advisor to technical advisor on plants to the production manager. And you will report to the production superintendents, production superintendent in your area. You will get a $25 a month raise in pay, and your title will be gasoline plant chief engineer. He says, when's this all take place? And I said, the first day of July. He says, okay, I'll write my resignation out to take effect on that day. He says, I can vouch that I could never get along with the production superintendent over here that I'd have to report to, and I don't think that any other plant superintendents at present will be able to go under the production superintendents and get along. As I remember, this day was the fifth day of June and was a Friday. So the next week I spent practically the whole week traveling to all the other plants, of which I think there was 12 at that time, and made all of them carrying the message. This one fellow Drumright was the only one that resigned right then, but others stuck it out, and as the fellow Drumright's deal that superintendents, plant superintendents couldn't get along with the production superintendent reporting to him proved to be very well and didn't work, and it only lasted a year and a half. But during that year and a half, two or three good plant superintendents more left the company, and practically all of them, however, got better jobs and went farther along in life than they would have if they had stayed as a plant superintendent for Shell. I got through with that job, went in and told the manager, I says, I've visited every one of them and told them. He says, how many is going to resign? I says, well, only one right now, but I think there'll be a couple more before too long if it continues. He said, okay. So I says, now what's going to happen to me? He said, well, you're going out to the Marshall plant, and that was the plant where I'd started in with Shell. Says, you're going out there and be a shift operator for a while, no reduction in pay. And said, after you get there and put in a few shifts, you'll probably realize why you're there. And I did. They was wanting to run an analysis on the effectiveness of the fellow that was now chief engineer, gasoline plant chief engineer. And his effectiveness wasn't good. During the time that I was still a traveling engineer, I was at one plant, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt had made executive recognition of Russia, and they had flooded the country with technicians learning all they could about our technology. A couple of them came to this plant where I was in charge of during the vacation of the plant superintendent, and I wanted to look at the plant. I called the department manager, and he's in Tulsa. He says, I don't care what you do with them, just whatever you see fit. And so I wouldn't even let them inside the gate at the plant. I told them no soap, that they couldn't come in. They waved their arms and fumed and stewed and said that I would never be able to visit Russia. And I told them, fine, there's no reason that I ever knew of that I was going to ever want to visit Russia. I didn't believe in communism, and I wasn't going there while they were communists. Not long after this happening, a friend of mine, not too well known at the time, but later became very well known, Wiley Post, approached me to say he and Will Rogers was going to fly around the world and wanted to know if I would go along as a pilot and mechanic. And Will Rogers knew absolutely nothing about mechanics or operations of an airplane. Absolutely nothing. And Wiley Post was not much of a mechanic himself. I told him, I said, I can't go because I can't go across Russia, and you're going to cross Siberia starting at Vladivostok and going clear on through Moscow and coming out over there someplace along about Poland. I said, the Russians have barred me from ever coming into Russia. And so a little later, I heard from Will Rogers, and he says, I can get you through Russia okay. And I said, you make your plans. Well, I didn't make any. I knew that the Russians weren't going to let me in, and besides, I wasn't too anxious to go on the trip. And so I never did tell anybody. I didn't tell Shell, didn't tell my family, didn't tell anybody that I'd have been approached to make this trip. And for when they got ready to leave, Will Rogers and Wiley Post set up in Seattle, Washington for a week, everybody wondering why they didn't proceed on to their round-the-world trip. And they were still trying to get approval for me to cross Russia, but it never did come. Finally, Will Rogers sent me a telegram saying, I guess I was wrong. I can't get you across Russia. We're going on. And most people know the tragic thing that happened in Alaska, that they crashed, and Will Rogers and Wiley Post were both killed. If I had been along, that wouldn't have happened, because an Eskimo on the site saw it happen, knew what was wrong, said that one of their magnetos didn't work right, and they'd tried to make it work, and it had failed just at the wrong time as they was trying to clear a bank about 20 feet high along this river, and that's what got them. I had been out at this Marshall plant working a graveyard shift, and I had gone in and gone to asleep after coming off work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and along about 9 o'clock somebody come knocked on the door and got me up, said that they wanted to talk to me on telephone out of the Tulsa office. I got up, and as I was putting the clothes on, I snapped on the radio, and they said, late yesterday evening, near 20 miles south of Fairbanks, Alaska, along, named the river, I don't remember the river now, they, Will Rogers and Wiley Post, had had a crash and were both killed. I went on and talked to the people on the telephone from the Tulsa office, and they said for me to get on over to the Lucene plant, that I was going to become the chief engineer there, which is a little plant about 35 miles over from the one that I was at this Marshall plant. My wife and daughter had gone back into Tulsa for a few days, and I had no car there, so I called over to the Lucene plant, the production office at Lucene, and asked them if they could come get me. They sent a car over and got me, took me over there, and said I had a utility car there I could use until my wife got back from Tulsa, which would be in a day or two, and that the moving van would be along for very long to move my furniture and stuff over there into a company house and pick up the man's furniture that was leaving there, going to another plant where chief engineer had left, and he was in line for that promotion, so he was going to move to that plant and taking me to that one. That wasn't at that time a very big plant, but and that winter it got pretty cold several times, and we had time with the cooling tower freezing up, and some of the boys, they let the tower get to be just a big block of ice inside, and so they said, how are we going to get it down? I said, well, it needs to be melted down from the top. So we stuck steam hoses in the basement into the tank on the bottom of the cooling tower in the big basin, heated that water up to almost boiling, and pumped it over the top without any draft, and melted the ice down from the top and then collapsed the cooling tower, which it could have very well have done. Along about March then, a railroad commission had put out an order that no more gas could be flared in that Lucene field. And and that the plant was going to have to be enlarged, actually more than tripled in size. And so they was getting ready to do that, and I was making a lot of tests and doing a lot of calculations on the new plant, laying out gathering systems and whatnot. And one day, a man that was the advisor to the production manager in the Tulsa office came out there and looked to see how we were doing and what we were doing, and I asked him where he was going to spend the night, and he said, well, he didn't know. He thought he would probably spend it in a hotel in Perry, which was a town some 30 miles away. So I said, well, would you like to come over to our house this evening for dinner? And he says, yes, he would. And so I called my wife and told her that this fellow was going to be there for dinner. And she cooked up some steak. And he came over there and sat there at our table and ate our steak and said, you're doing a good job here, and I'm going to recommend that you stay here and be in charge of this plant when it's enlarged. And so we thanked him. A day or two later, I got a letter from a woman that was a friend of my wife's in the office in Tulsa. She was in the secretarial pool, and she sent a copy of this letter that this fellow had written after he got back into the Tulsa office. Instead of recommending that I be left there in charge of the plant after it was enlarged, that I be terminated, clear out of the company just as soon as they could get somebody to replace me there. I never did know what this fellow had against me or why he was so two-faced about it. Anyway, the production manager didn't go along with it, and they just barely got started on the construction of enlarging the plant when the assistant production manager came out one day and says, we've got a job up at Avant that you're the only man in the organization and we think can straighten the problem out. Or, you know, he says, we've got a problem. He didn't say where it was. He says, we've got a problem that we've got to straighten out, and we think you're the only man who can straighten it out. And I says, oh, up at Avant, and when do you want me to go? And he says, right away, because the thing is not doing anything at all up there right now. And people up there say that you're the only man in the organization that can straighten it out. So I said, okay. He says, now go up there and look at the house that you company house you live in and get it and to repaint it or whatever needs to be done to it to make it livable, and we'll move you up there right away after that. So my wife and I went up and looked and told them what was needed, and needed a kitchen cabinet and a few other things like that, as it didn't have any built-ins at all. And I reported this to the assistant production manager, which he had told me to do, and he says, it'll be fixed right up, right away. And so he called me one day at the sluicing plant, says, there'll be a man down, take your place Monday morning, and there'll be a truck there Tuesday morning to take you your stuff up to Avant. The man got there Monday morning, and Tuesday I showed him around and got him familiar with what had to be done and what was going on in the way of construction of the new plant. And Tuesday morning the truck came in and picked my stuff up and took it over to Avant. And when we got there, wasn't a thing done in the house except some used paint or some spare paint they'd had left over. And I never saw such a conglomeration of colors in a house in my life. And it was awful. My wife said she wasn't going to live there and that kind of a thing. I got on the phone call the assistant production manager.